There will be no sonograms, Yossa. Like all of us, Jessica has the ability to determine for herself if anything has gone wrong during the gestation period. We trust her. Jessica had looked up at her mentor and fought a stinging sensation in her eyes. Thank you, Reverend Mother. Mohiam's gaze had searched for answers, though Jessica would not provide them, voluntarily or otherwise. Now the Duke's concubine sat alone on the balcony, blanketed in the imperial sunset. She thought of the skies on Caladan, of the storms that came swiftly across the sea. Over the past several standard months, she and Leto had exchanged numerous letters and gifts, but such tokens were not nearly enough for either of them. Though Kaitane held many treasures to amaze visitors, Jessica wanted to be back on her ocean world with the man she loved, at peace, leading her former life. What if the Sisterhood exiles me after our son is born? What if they kill the baby? Jessica continued to make entries in the bound journal Lady Anirule had given to her, jotting down impressions and ideas, using a coded language of her own devising. She recorded her innermost thoughts, filling page after page with plans for her unborn son and for her relationship with Leto. In this process, however, she avoided writing about an increasingly unsettled feeling that she did not understand, and which she hoped would go away. What if she had made a terribly wrong decision? We depend entirely upon the benevolent cooperation of the unconscious mind. The unconscious, in a sense, invents the next moment for us. Bene Gesserit Precept. When Anirule awakened, she discovered that the medical sister had been monitoring and adjusting her medication to keep the disturbed clamor of other memory from overwhelming her. Good color in your skin, alertness in your eyes. Excellent, Lady Anirule. Yossa smiled gently, reassuringly. Anirule managed to sit up on her bed, overcoming a wave of weakness. She felt almost recovered, almost sane. For now. Margaret Fenring and Mohiam scurried into the bedchamber, wearing anxious expressions that would have earned them a scolding rebuke if she had been feeling better. Margaret changed the polarity of the filter field at a private patio door, allowing bright sunlight into the room. Anirule shielded her eyes and sat up straighter in bed so that the warm golden sunlight splashed across her skin. I can't spend my life in darkness. To her intent, Bene Gesserit listeners, she explained the nightmare of the desert sandworm fleeing an unseen, unknown pursuer. I must determine what this dream means while the terror is still fresh in my mind. The skin on her face began to feel hot in the sunlight, as if she had been sunburned by her vision. The medical sister tried to interrupt, but Anirule shooed her away. Frowning in brittle disapproval, Yossa left her alone with the other two women, closing the door behind her a bit more forcefully than necessary. Anirule walked barefoot to the terrace, into full sunlight. Instead of recoiling from the heat, she stood naked and unself-conscious, absorbing the rays of the sun on her bare skin. I journeyed to the brink of madness and came back. She experienced a strange longing to roll on hot sand. The three sisters stood beside a waving Imian rosebush at the terrace. Dreams are always triggered by conscious events, Mohiam said, paraphrasing a Bene Gesserit teaching. Contemplating, Anirule picked one of the tiny yellow Imian roses from the bush beside her. As the sensitive flower flinched, she lifted it to her nose to smell the delicate scent. I think it has something to do with the Emperor, spice, and Arrakis. Have you heard of Project Amal? One day I walked into my husband's study while he was discussing such a project with Count Fenring. They were arguing about the Tleilaxu. Both of them fell awkwardly silent, as guilty men always do. Shaddam told me not to meddle in affairs of state. All men behave strangely, Reverend Mother Mohiam observed. That has long been known. Margaret frowned. Hasimir keeps trying to hide the fact that he spends so much time on Ix, and I often wonder why. Just an hour ago he ruined a dress that I wore especially for him, knocked a cup of spiced coffee out of my hands before I could sip from it, as if it were poison. I used some melange I found in a secret luggage compartment. She narrowed her eyes. It was in a pouch with a marking on it, the Tleilaxu symbol for A. Amal, perhaps? Quietly, the Emperor has been sending military resources to Ix, while keeping that information hidden from the Landsrad. Fenring, Ix, Tleilaxu, melange, Anirul said. No good can come of this. And Shaddam has declared open war on spice hoarders, Mohiam said. Even in the brightness of day, her wrinkled face seemed to absorb new shadows. All roads lead to melange. Perhaps the sandworm in my dream was fleeing from a storm of upheavals in the Imperium. Still naked in the sunlight, Anirul stared across the palace grounds. We must contact Mother Superior right away. Simplicity is the most difficult of all concepts. Mentat Conundrum. The Emperor sat alone in one of his private banquet halls, mercifully without his wife. He smiled with anticipation as the lavish 6-course meal was brought in for him. At the moment he wanted no troubles, no politics, not even old war stories from the supreme Bashar Garon. Just a private, luxurious celebration. The briefing about Corona, and the detailed hollow images of the explosion, had been enough to give him quite an appetite. The first serving tray was a scrolled silver platter carried by a pair of nubile young women. Fanfare blared, announcing the 3 skewers of lightly seasoned slig cubes, cooked to perfection, that graced the tray. The serving girls removed 1 skewer at a time, plucked off each cube of meat, and took turns placing the morsels onto Shaddam's imperial tongue. The savory meat was as tender as moist cheese, with sensuous flavors that snapped his taste buds awake. Sardaukar marksmen held weapons ready, prepared to react instantly if one of the women attempted to use a blunted skewer as an assassination device. A golden-skinned young man in a creamy white toga poured a goblet of rich claret. Shaddam sipped the wine in between bites as the 2 girls awaited his pleasure, holding more cubes of meat. He drew a deep breath, smelling the carefully chosen scents that wafted around the servants. Decadent! This was what it meant to be emperor. He sighed and gestured for the next dish. The 2nd course consisted of succulent broiled crustaceans, many-legged but eyeless creatures that were found only in underground springs on Belitejus. The sauce was butter, salt, and garlic. Nothing more. But it tasted delicious. 2 wenches used tiny platinum forks to pry out the crustacean's sweet white flesh and feed it to the emperor. Before the next dish could be brought, however, Count Hasimir Fenring stormed into the banquet hall, elbowing aside the guards as if impervious to their weapons. Shaddam wiped his mouth with a napkin. "Ah, Hasimir, when did you return from your travels? You've been gone a long time." Fenring could barely keep the strangled quality from his voice. "You destroyed Corona, hmm? How could you do such a thing without consulting me first?" "The Landsrat members can complain all they want, but we caught the Richesians red-handed." Shaddam had never seen his friend so angry. He switched to the private code they had developed as boys, so the servants could not eavesdrop. "Calm yourself. Or would you prefer that I never summon you to Kaitain again? As we've discussed, we needed to improve the market advantage of Amal by eliminating Melange. This got rid of another major stockpile." Fenring moved forward with a prowling gait, grabbed a chair beside the Emperor's, and sat himself down. "But you used atomic, Shaddam. Not only did you attack a great house, but you used forbidden atomics." He brought his hand down on the table surface with a loud smack. Shaddam gestured with his fingers, and the serving girls whisked away the Tajusian crustaceans. Too late, a serving boy hurried in with a flagon of golden mead. But Shaddam waved him away and signaled for the third course. The Emperor decided not to raise his voice. "The Great Convention forbids the use of atomics only against people, Hasimir. I used atomics to destroy a man-made structure, a laboratory moon where Richies had stored an illegal spice hoard. I was fully within my rights." "But hundreds of people died, maybe thousands." Shaddam shrugged. "They were given notice. If they chose not to evacuate in time, how can I be held responsible? You just don't like me to take actions without your advice, Hasimir." Fenring simmered, but the Emperor smiled maddeningly. "Ah, look, here comes the next course." Two strong men walked in carrying a thin stone slab on which slumped an imperial peacock roasted in herbs, its browned skin still crackling from the heat. Servants rushed forward with a clean plate, silverware, and a crystal goblet for Count Fenring. "Did you at least get a legal opinion before the attack, hmm? To make certain your interpretation would stand up in Landsrat Court?" "It seems obvious enough to me. Supreme Bashar Garon took hollow images of the whole scene on Corona. The evidence is incontrovertible." With an exaggerated sigh of forced patience, Fenring said, "Would you like me to obtain an opinion, sire? Shall I consult with your law techs and mentats?" "Oh, I suppose. Go ahead." With gusto, Shaddam dug into the first slices of juicy peacock meat, licking his lips after swallowing. "Try some, Hasimir." The count picked at the roast bird on his silver plate, but didn't taste anything. "You worry too much. Besides, I am the Emperor, and can do as I please." Fenring looked at him with large eyes. "You are the Emperor because of support from the Landsrat, Choam, the Spacing Guild, the Bene Gesserit, and other powerful forces. Should they all grow displeased, you would be stripped of everything." "They wouldn't dare," Shaddam said, then lowered his voice. "Now that I am the only male Corino." "But there are plenty of eligible noblemen who would love to marry your daughters and continue the dynasty." Fenring pounded the table again. "Let me find a way to salvage this, Shaddam. I think you will need to appear before the Landsrat in 2 days' time. They will be in an uproar. You must state your reasons, and we'll pull together all the support we can manage. Otherwise, mark my words, there will be a revolt." "Yes, yes." Shaddam concentrated on his food, then snapped his fingers. "Will you stay for the next course, Hasimir? It's seared boar steaks from Kanidar. Just arrived by Highliner this morning. Fresh." Fenring pushed his plate away and stood up. "You have given me much work to do. I must begin immediately." law always moves in the direction of protecting the strong and oppressing the weak. Dependence upon force corrodes justice. Crown Prince Raphael Corino, Precepts of Civilization. Though he loathed the arrogant Premier Calamar, Baron Harkonnen had never expected Shaddam to use atomics against House Ritchies. Atomics! When the news reached him on Arrakis, he had mixed feelings and a good deal of fear for his own security. In the face of the Emperor's appalling zeal, no one was safe, especially not House Harkonnen, which had so much to hide. Buoyed by his suspensor belt, the Baron paced his strategy room in the Carthag residency, looking through a convex wall of armor-plaz windows. Blazing desert sunshine streamed in, tempered by filtering films on the 2-centimeter-thick windows. Muffled by barriers and humming security systems, he heard preparations for the military parade that was scheduled to occur soon in the main square. Just beyond his field of vision, troops assembled in the afternoon heat, each fully armed man in a blue dress uniform. With grand fanfare, the Baron had returned to the harsh planet accompanied by his nephew. Brutish Raban, in one of his rare moments of intelligence, had suggested that they remain here close to the spice operations until the troubling imperial matters were resolved. The Baron slammed a fist against one of the windows, causing the plaz to quiver. How much more did Shaddam intend to do? It was madness. Fully a dozen Lansrad families had voluntarily surrendered fortunes in hoarded spice, pathetically contrite, in order to avoid further demonstrations of imperial wrath. No one is safe. It was only a matter of time before Choam auditors came sniffing around Harkonnen spice operations on Arrakis, which could well be the end of the Baron and his great house, unless he managed to hide everything. Exacerbating his problems, the damnable Fremen kept preying on his secret stockpiles, locating many of the largest caches. The desert vermin were opportunists, exploiting the imperial crackdown, knowing the Baron could report none of their raids, because then he would have to admit his own crimes. Outside, giant banners bearing the blue Harkonnen crest streamed down the sides of tall buildings, oceans of limp cloth hanging in the hot air. Griffin statues had been erected around the Carthag residency, towering monsters that seemed ready to defy even the great sandworms. The mandatory crowds were assembled in the square, wretches chased from their begging stations and dingy homes, so that they could cheer on cue. Normally, the Baron preferred to spend his wealth on personal diversions. But now he took a page from the Emperor's book. With finery and gaudy spectacles, he would cow the indigent population. It made him feel a little better after the embarrassing banquet debacle. Henceforth, he had no intention of attempting to follow the Atreides model for inspiring goodwill. Baron Vladimir Harkonnen wanted his subjects to fear him, not to like him. A guild courier fidgeted at the open doorway to the strategy room, showing the edge of her patience. "Baron, my highliner will depart in less than 2 hours. If you have a package for the Emperor, I must take it soon." Angered, the big man whirled, and the momentum kept him moving gracelessly on his suspensors. He caught himself against a wall. "You will wait. An important part of my message will be images from the parade we are about to host." The courier's hair was short and wine-colored, her features hard and unattractive. "I will remain only as long as time permits." With a grunt of displeasure, the Baron floated in an exaggerated posture of dignity back to his writing table. Grumbling to himself, he could not think of the proper way to phrase the rest of his message, and wished Peter de Vries were here to help. But the twisted Mentat remained on Kaitain, spying on his behalf. Perhaps he should have kept that etiquette advisor alive. For all his preposterous training, Mephistus Crewe had known how to compose a polite turn of phrase. With pudgy fingers, the Baron scrawled another sentence, then sat back, thinking how best to explain the recent rash of accidents and lost spice excavation equipment on Arrakis, with which he had hidden his embezzling activities. In a recent imperial transmittal, Shaddam had expressed concern about the problem. For once, the Baron was glad the Spacing Guild had never managed to put up adequate weather surveillance satellites here. This enabled him to assert that brief, vicious storms had occurred, when, in actuality, they had not. But perhaps he had gone too far, and too many clues pointed toward his activities. These are dangerous times. "As I have reported to you before, sire, we have been plagued by Fremen unrest," he wrote. "The terrorists destroy equipment, then steal our cargoes of melange and disappear into the desert before a proper military response can be mounted." The Baron pursed his lips, trying to select the proper tone of contrition. "I admit that we have, perhaps, been too lenient with them, but now that I am back on Arrakis, I will personally supervise our retaliation efforts. We will grind down the unruly natives and make them bow under Harkonnen command, in the glorious name of your Imperial Majesty." He thought his words might be a bit too extravagant, but decided to let them stand. Shaddam was not a man to complain about excessive compliments. The Fremen rogues had recently stolen an armored spice transport and another stockpile hidden in an abandoned desert village. How had the filthy guerrillas known to strike there? The courier continued to fidget at the doorway, but the Baron ignored her. "I promise you this unrest will no longer be tolerated, sire," he wrote. "I will send regular reports of our success in bringing the traitors to justice." With a flourish, he signed the letter, sealed it in the message cylinder, and slapped the ornate tube into the courier's palm. Without a word, the wine-haired woman spun about and made her way through the halls, heading toward the Carthag spaceport. The Baron shouted after her, "Stand by on the highliner for transmitted images to go with that message. My parade is about to begin." Next, he summoned his nephew to the strategy room. Despite Raban's many flaws, the Baron had in mind a job the beast could perform well. The big-shouldered man strode in, carrying his much-used ink-vine whip. In a gaudy blue uniform with gold tassels and lapels decked with clusters of medals, he had dressed as if he meant to be the center of the military display in the main square, rather than an observer from a high balcony. "Raban, we must show the Emperor how angry we are over these recent Fremen activities." The thick lips smiled cruelly, as if the beast already anticipated what he would be told to do. "Do you want me to round up some suspects and interrogate them? I'll make them confess to whatever you like." Outside, the blare of trumpets cracked through the dry air, announcing the arrival of the Harkonnen troops. "Not good enough, Raban. I want you to select three villages. I don't care which ones. Point your fingers at a map, if you like. March in with commandos and raise the settlements to the ground. Level every building. Kill all the people. Leave only black spots in the desert. Maybe I'll write up a decree explaining their supposed crimes, and you can scatter copies among the carnage, so the rest of the Fremen rabble can read it." Again trumpets blew outside in the square. The Baron accompanied his nephew out onto the observation platform. A sullen crowd filled the square, unwashed bodies whose stench reached him even here, three floors up. The Baron could only imagine how unbearable the smell must be down there in the heat. "Entertain yourself," the Baron said, twiddling his ring-studded fingers. "One day your brother Fade will be old enough to accompany you on these instructive exercises." Raban nodded. "We'll teach those lawless bandits who wields the real power here." The Baron responded in a distracted tone. "Yes, I know." The soldiers lined up in their ceremonial uniforms, lovely, muscular men, a sight that never failed to stimulate the Baron. The parade began. Every man has the same final destination, death at the end of life's road. But the path we travel makes all the difference. Some of us have maps and goals. Others are just lost. Prince Rombervernius, ruminations at a fork in the road. Trapped on the stranded highliner, Gurney Halleck stared out the frigate porthole at the airless void of the cargo hold. Hundreds of ships hung precariously in their berths, clustered together, some smashed and upended. Aboard those craft, many people must be injured or dead. Next to him, still wearing the concealing cloak and cowl, Romber studied the highliner's framework, reassembling details from a blueprint in his mind. 2 hours earlier, another holoprojection of the odd-looking flight auditor had appeared inside each ship. "We have no additional information. Please stand by." Then the images had dissolved. The highliner held numerous cargo ships and transport frigates, some of which were filled with foodstuffs, medicines, and trading goods, enough to keep the tens of thousands of passengers alive for months. Gurney wondered if they would remain marooned out here until starving people began to attack each other. Already some passengers were nervously gorging themselves on personal supplies. Gurney remained far from despair, though. In his younger days, he had survived Harkonnen slave pits and had escaped from Gedi Prime by concealing himself in a shipment of blue obsidian. After that, he could tolerate going astray on a spaceship. Abruptly, Romber lunged to his feet with his balisette and turned his scarred face toward his companion. "This is driving me mad." The sinews of the prince's neck stood out, so that Gurney could make out the polymer connections where human muscles had been grafted onto prosthetic parts. "The guild is full of administrators, bureaucrats, and bankers. The support staff on a highliner performs only menial duties. None of them has much expertise in these vessels or the Holtzmann engines." "What are you getting at?" Gurney looked around. "How can I help?" Romber's gaze took on the rigid, expectant stare of a leader, eerily similar to the countenance of Dominic Vernius, which Gurney remembered so well. "I have spent my life like the passengers on this guild ship, waiting for someone else to solve my problems, expecting the situation to fix itself. And I won't do it any longer. I must try, no matter the result." "We have to keep our identities secret in order to complete our mission." "Yes, but we can't help Ix unless we can get there." Romber went to the nearest observation porthole, staring out at the other ships trapped there. "I'm willing to wager that I know more about the intricacies of this ship than any other person aboard. Emergency situations call for strong leadership, and the Spacing Guild doesn't staff its regular passenger vessels with strong leaders." Gurney placed their balisettes in a storage locker, but did not bother to lock it. "Then I am at your side. I've sworn to protect you and assist you in any way." Romber looked out a large window at the convoluted catwalks and structural girders that formed the giant ship's framework. His gaze acquired an unfocused quality, as if he were trying to recall subtle details. "Come with me. I know the way to the navigator's chamber." With many of his ingrained memories recovered after the tragedy of his accident, Romber recalled a plethora of access codes and the locations of unmarked hatches that laced the highliner's inner hull decks like boreholes in wormwood. Though the programming had been installed decades ago during the construction of the vessel, Dominic Vernius had always left secret access points for his family as a routine precaution. Guild security men were doing their best to keep passengers aboard their individual ships, while allowing a limited number of people to wander into the galleries and assembly areas within the hull decks. But in the midst of turmoil and frightened passengers, security could not watch every path, Romber's cyborg legs did not tire, and Gurney followed with his rolling gait. The cowled prince marched along a damaged but still serviceable catwalk. Even making use of lift platforms and caged-in conveyors, it took the pair hours to reach the upper high-security decks. When he activated a hatch and stepped into a garishly lit chamber, Romber startled 7 guild representatives in the midst of an urgent conference around a heavy table. The guildsmen sat up, their normally dull eyes flashing silver. Most of them looked subtly altered from the human norm. One man had puffy ears and a narrow face. Another had tiny hands and eyes. And yet another had stiff limbs, as if he lacked knees and elbows. Based upon their distinctive lapel badges, the Ixian prince identified root administrators, a roly-poly guild banker, a legate to Choam, an ancient guild mentat, and the fish-eyed flight auditor who had served as hollow spokesman. "How did you get in here?" the roly-poly banker demanded. "We are in the middle of a crisis. You must return to your..." A flurry of guards rushed in, blades drawn. One man carried a stunner. Romber stepped forward, with Gurney at his side. "I have something important to say, and to do." Arriving at a crucial decision, he put a hand to the hood that covered his head. "As a nobleman, I invoke the guild's code of secrecy." The guards took several steps closer. Slowly, Romber pulled down his hood to reveal the metal plate on the back of his skull, the lumpy burn marks and poorly healed lacerations on his face. As he opened the robe, the guildsman could see his bulky armored arms, his prosthetic legs, the life support systems woven into his clinging garments. "Let me see the navigator. I may be able to help." The 7 guild representatives around the table looked at each other and spoke in a clipped language, shorthand for thought impulses and words. The prince strode to the edge of their table. His limbs thrummed with power, and the pumps in his chest drew in breaths, filtered them, and metabolized oxygen, adding chemical energy to the battery packs that powered his artificial organs. The elderly guild mentat regarded the cyborg intruder with hardly a glance at Gurney Halleck. Holding up one hand, palm out, the mentat gestured for the security men to leave. "We require privacy." When they were gone, the aged man said, "You are Prince Romber Vernius of Ix. We learned of your presence on this craft, and of the fee that you paid to keep it secret." His roomy eyes studied the mechanical enhancements of Romber's body. "Do not be concerned for your secret," said the flight auditor. He placed his 2 short arms on the table. "Your identity is safe with us." Gazing around the table, Romber said, "I understand how this highliner was constructed. In fact, on its maiden voyage, I watched a navigator guide it through fold space to move it from the caverns of Ix." He paused, letting his words sink in. "But I suspect our predicament has nothing to do with the Holtzman engines. You would know that as well as I do." Like a lightning thought that skittered around the table, the guildsmen abruptly sat straighter, putting together the implications of Romber's identity, his disguise, and his destination. "Know this, Prince," the pudgy banker added. "The guild would not object to seeing House Vernius restored to Ix. The Bene Tlaelox have no vision or efficiency. Highliner production and quality have fallen off drastically, and we have been forced to reject some ships because of inadequate workmanship. This has harmed our revenues. The Spacing Guild would benefit from your return to power. In fact, the entire Imperium would be well served if you were to..." Gurney interrupted. "Nobody said anything about that. We're just travelers maintaining a low profile." He looked sharply at Romber. "And at the moment, this ship isn't going anywhere." Romber nodded. "I need to see the navigator." The chamber was a large, round-walled aquarium, sealed with armored glass and filled with the cinnamon-orange fog of melange gas. The mutated navigator, with webbed hands and atrophied feet, should have floated without gravity inside the chamber. Instead, the creature's distorted form lay slumped and motionless in the spice fog, its shrunken eyes glassy and unfocused. "The navigator collapsed while folding space," explained the flight auditor. "We don't know where we are. We cannot rouse him." The Guild Mentat coughed and said, "Traditional navigation techniques are unable to pinpoint our location. We are far beyond the edge of known space." One of the root administrators shouted into a speaking screen on the wall, "Navigator, respond! Steersman!" The creature twitched on the floor, proving that he was still alive, but no words came from the puckered, fleshy mouth. Gurney looked around at the 7 guildsmen. "How are we going to help him? Are there any medical facilities for these creatures?" "Navigators require no medical attention." The flight auditor blinked his wide-set eyes. "Melange gives them life and health. Melange makes them more than human." Gurney rolled his lumpy shoulders. "Melange isn't doing enough right now. We need this navigator to recover so we can return to the Imperium." "I want to go inside the chamber," Romber said. "Perhaps I can rouse him. He might be able to tell me what went wrong." The guildsmen looked at each other. "Impossible." The plump banker gestured with a stubby-fingered hand toward the murk of spice. "Such a concentration of melange would be fatal to anyone not adapted to it. You cannot breathe the air." Romber placed a prosthetic hand on his own barrel chest, where the cyborg bellows of his mechanical diaphragm caused him to inhale and exhale in a precise rhythm. "I do not have human lungs." The realization made Gurney laugh with astonishment. Even if concentrated melange damaged organic tissues, Dr. Yue's artificial metabolizers should protect Romber, for a short while at least. In the sealed chamber, the navigator stirred again, on the verge of death. Finally, the odd-looking group of guildsmen agreed. The flight auditor evacuated the sealed umbilical corridor behind the navigator's tank, knowing that some of the potent gas would leak out when the hatch was opened. Romber clasped Gurney's hand, careful not to squeeze hard enough to break his friend's bones. "Thank you for your faith in me, Gurney Halleck." He paused, thinking of Tessia, then turned to the hatch. "When this is over, we'll have to add a few more verses to our epic song." The troubadour warrior clapped the Ixion on the shoulder, then ducked back into the protected corridor with the guildsman, who sealed the entrance. Romber approached the rear access panel that the bloated form of the navigator could no longer pass through. Before proceeding, he increased the filtration levels of his cyborg breathing mechanism and decreased his respiration requirements. Drawing upon his body's power cells, he hoped to function for a time without having to inhale the melange gas. He disengaged the lock of the access hatch and broke the seal with a hiss. Then he yanked open the round doorway, crawled inside, and closed it behind him to retain as much of the orange fog as possible. His organic eye stung, and the olfactory receptors, still functional in his nostrils, screamed against the potent reek of acrid aromatic esters. The prince took a tentative step forward, walking with leaden feet, as if immersed in a slow, drug-induced dream. Ahead, through shifting visibility, he spotted the navigator's naked, fleshy form. Not human anymore, but some sort of atavistic mistake. A creature that had never been meant to reproduce. Romber bent to touch the soft skin. The navigator turned his massive head and tiny inset eyes toward him. The shriveled mouth twitched and opened to exhale rusty clouds of gas without a sound. He blinked at Romber as if assessing possibilities, sorting through memories and groping for primitive words with which he could communicate.
"Prince Romber Vernius."
"You know my name?" Romber was surprised, but remembered that navigators possessed prescient powers.
"Demur," the creature said in a long, low whisper. "I was Demur Pilru."
"Demur! I knew you as a young man!" None of the navigator's features was recognizable.
"No time, threat, outside force, evil, drawing closer, beyond the Imperium."
"A threat? What kind of threat? Is it coming here?"
"Ancient enemy, future enemy, cannot remember. Time folds, space folds, memory fails."
"Do you know what's wrong with you?" Romber's words buzzed as he forced them through his enhanced larynx without drawing breaths. "How can we help you?"
"Tainted spice gas in tank," Demur struggled to say. "Prescience fails. Navigation error. Must escape. Return to known space. The enemy has seen us."
Romber had no idea which enemy he meant, or if the injured Demur was having delusions. "Tell me what to do. I want to help."
"I can guide. First spice gas must be changed. Remove poison. Bring fresh spice."
Romber stood back, uneasy about the strange, unidentified threat. He didn't understand what could be wrong with the melange gas, but at least he understood how to fix the problem. He had no time to lose. "I'll have the guildsmen exchange the spice in your tank, and you'll be fine soon. Where is your backup supply?"
"None."
Romber felt cold. If the guild had no spice stockpile aboard the marooned Highliner, they had no hope of finding Melange out here in deep, uncharted space.
"No backup supply on board,"